Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the World of Ideas. I'm your host, Kasan Henry. It's May 10th, 2015. We're back to continue our Black Lives series. We're up to part 8, and we are moving forward with the issues of African Americans in the United States. And today's show is based on Freddie Gray, the Freddie Gray tragedy in Baltimore. And what we're going to talk about today is what we can learn from that tragedy. Before we get straight into that, let me recap a little bit. We are going to continue this series a few more weeks to squeeze out as much juice as possible so that we can move forward and prevent the nonsensical killings of our fellow citizens. So let's get to our review of the week. I have the dangerous idea and a great idea. First off, let's get into this dangerous idea. People keep saying that there are more black men in the criminal justice system than in college. People, please do some more research on this. This is over and over and over turning out to be completely false. Now, that is not to say that the number of African Americans, the number of minorities, constitute a disproportionate percentage of incarcerated people in the United States, and that the number is overwhelmingly high and too big of a share of our demographic are locked up or stained by the criminal justice system. All right, all of those things are true. But we need to make sure the narrative holds on all ends and represents everything that's going on. All right. It's not all bad in a sense that not every black man is in jail. In fact, there are more black men in college than in jail. All right. Here's a statistics from the National Center for Educational, our National Center for Educational Statistics. Here's their statistic. From 2001, about 693,044 black men went to college, and that number increased to 1,437,363 in 2013. That's huge. It's huge. All right, it's like it doubled, more than doubled. Ridiculously huge. We have to acknowledge that. If we do not acknowledge that, then we are discrediting a trend that we worked so hard for. And this is what happens when we are overly cynical and nihilistic and defeatist. So stop. We got to stop, people. Especially those of you who are very concerned about the welfare of African Americans in the United States, okay? Please make sure you identify the success and the progress that are out here going along, running concurrently with the, okay, horrible trends that are going on. We cannot afford to disregard our strengths, because it may be the strengths that helps us overcome our weaknesses. And this is a bit of a game theory, which is very important. Game theory. And, you know, I probably shouldn't use the game theory. It's a part of the art of war as well. So let's get this straight. Now, we know that there are way too many people in jail. In general, there are just way too many people in jail in general. In fact, here the NAACP give us some stats. From 1980 to 2008, the number of people incarcerated in America quadrupled from roughly 500,000 to 2.3 million people. That's a lot. Of the 2.3 million people, African Americans now constitute nearly 1 million of the total 2.3 million incarcerated population. All right, so African Americans are more likely to get caught up in crime or in circumstances that lead them to jails, and circumstances that unfortunately won't necessarily need someone who is not black to jail. So we have a big problem with that. Let's make sure we frame these problems correctly, because if we don't, we run the risk of making these problems worse by not acknowledging the true nature of what's going on, acknowledging the true nature of what's going on as best we can. Of course, it takes time. Then we're able to be more efficient with our resources and with our rhetoric. And also, when we push for certain policies, we, at any point when we're successful in getting a policy signed into law, it'll be something that targets that which is really wrong, not the narrative, not the myth. So let's get this straight. This is a myth. The notion that more black men in criminal, that there are more black men in criminal justice systems than in college. That's a myth. And we have to challenge this myth. People are using this myth. For example, and some people I think are willingly using it. I think a lot of people are just going along with what they hear, and it just appears that way. And so a lot of people like to avoid statistics and just go on their own perception and not realizing that usually our perception is a bit biased, especially when you're living in a particular community and looking at the scenarios that you come in contact with yourself, not realizing that the world is much bigger than your neighborhood. But anyway, going back, the reason why I brought this up as a dangerous idea, because Ben Carson, who's running for president, had recently said on April 22nd, 2015, in a speech, there are more young black males involved in the criminal justice system than there are in higher education. That's completely false. Let's get it right. Now, let me be honest. I'll be forthcoming about this. Obama made the same mistake when he was running. All right, so it's sort of a go-to piece of narrative to let people know that, you know, I'm aware of what's going wrong, what's going on, what's all wrong, and I'm going to be able to come help you. I see the problems, and I'm here to help you. I understand that's politics. That's fine. I expect certain people to say that. Also, I do feel that some people are aware of the veracity or lack of veracity of their sayings, of their comments and stuff. So be that as it may, I think it's just my job to announce some stuff that's going on behind the scenes. All right. And I acknowledge my bias. My bias that I tend to see things half full. I tend to see the cup half full rather than half empty. All right. And so I lay that card out there. But this is a trend. So this is not just merely my perception. This is not merely me saying, all right, I wish to see the cup. I wish to interpret the cup as being half full. No, not in this case. I'm sorry, folks. Really, this is going off of some comparative statistics. I recommend that you do the same. And if you find something, email me. Okay? Email the show, info@theworldofideas.com. And let me know what you find. Let's get to the bottom of this. Until then, this notion that there are more black people involved, you know, or locked up than in college. No, that's a slap in the face to the men who are black men who are in college. And, you know, as a teacher, too, one of the tactics that teachers have to be mindful of is giving more attention to the students who interrupt, to some of the jerks, than to those who are actually trying to do the right thing. Okay? And And so what happens is that behavior, the behavior that receives attention becomes reinforced. It becomes the behavior to aim for, to just to be acknowledged. All right. So there's a lot of stuff we can get into that with that. But this is where I'm at. So I'm not saying ignore. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not going the opposite way and saying don't state facts. Don't state facts that show our skeletons, show the skeletons of our society. No, bring them up at all times. But also, don't just stop there. Right? There are two sides to this coin, to the coin of African-American history. There are two sides to it. And we have to look at both sides. And I'm afraid that we're only looking at one side, at least the narrative that's being projected. And many of the people who cite such quotes as this, you know, are black. They tend to be black. So I'm not talking about the media narrative, really, alone. I'm talking about people in the community, parents and local citizens in the barbershop or in a coffee shop or wherever. We need to know that. All right, let's move on to great idea, an amazing idea or event in this case, Liberia. Liberia is technically, I guess, free from Ebola. It's free of Ebola. And this is a declaration coming from the World Health Organization, WHO. All right, and this article, you can find this article in the New York Times. I think that's amazing. I think that this is amazing. People panicked and everybody screamed conspiracy theory. And you know how that goes. And I'm not saying conspiracy theories don't exist. They do exist. But folks, please, you know, it's up to the citizens really to exercise rational thinking and research, we have to develop a tempered mindset. I mean, we all are sort of conditioned by certain pasts and outlooks on the world, even myself. But at the same time, we are holding a responsibility to be reasoned creatures on this earth. So let's start doing that. All right. Now, I'm not saying I won't panic necessarily if, like, everybody in my neighborhood just started dropping like flies. All right. That I can get. Right. If somebody, and if it's you, I can get. But, you know, dealing with the information and the technology and resources and stuff that we have now, we need to think through that reality instead of panicking. And what the panic did, it allowed people to just make certain, I think, baseless claims, and then actually incited phobia and disarray. And that's not cool. That's not cool. Again, it's like military or game theory. You can't panic, man. Or woman. You can't panic. I mean, you can if you want, but I mean, if you're trying to move forward, if you want to secure the best scenario, you got to stop panicking the way we do. So this is really cool. I think this is nice. I think this is wonderful. I would scream if I didn't think it would affect my image, firstly, here. But this is really wonderful. Let me read a little bit of this. So we have the New York Times. I have it here. This came out yesterday. So the World Health Organization declared Liberia free of Ebola on Saturday, making it the first of the three hardest hit West African countries to bring a formal end to the epidemic. That's great. You know what else about this I found? All right, so they did a whole bunch of tests. So no, it's not like somebody just said, hey, we're just free of Ebola. All right, there was a trial period and everything, and it passed. It was an extensive one. You can find this article and get that info for yourself. But what I like about this, I discovered a group called Doctors Without Borders. Excellent. It's excellent. You know, if you leave it up to the cynics, the nihilists, you ain't going to hear this stuff. It's always about what's going wrong. And, you know, this organization, Doctors Without Borders, it's really cool. People who are seeing the world as their home. Willing to leave America to go into the heat of the battle. We need to support initiatives like this. We need to create more of them in different, and of course, in different dimensions, in different scenarios. It doesn't have to be something as grandiose as Doctors Without Borders. But I think thinking along these lines in the community, in schools, in our local businesses will help us unite and create, one, first of all, a huge safety net. Two, and it would create a healthier environment, a healthier social and political and economic environment. Okay, so that we can prosper as human beings. All right, so that's it for the two ideas. I spent a lot of time on these two ideas, but I definitely had to get that first one out, that dangerous one, this notion that more black men are in the criminal justice system. Too many are, but let's get it right, all right? We have more in college than in jail. And the ones that are in jail, we need to help out. And the whole idea that there are people around the world who are fighting on our behalf to rid it of fatal diseases. All right? We need to give people a hand. Just because we're healthy now, we're able to enjoy the amenities of technology, does not mean we are not connected and we have no influence on the state of our home planet Earth. Okay, that's it for the first part of this show. We're going to take a quick break here. Got some music pumping. What I'm going to do is let you all get ready to rumble, and we're going to move on towards this discussion on what we can learn from Freddie Gray, from the Freddie Gray tragedy. Okay, which I feel is symbolic of all the other of tragedies that have been going on. But there are some points I want to make so that we can take away and spread and affect change. Yes, we can. Be right back after this break. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the show. So let's move forward. We're going to get on this train. Yeah, we're going to take a few stops. Each stop you can consider as a, sort of a lesson. And so what I want to propose is that there are some things we can learn from the Freddie Gray tragedy. It teaches us at least three lessons that I want to share. And if we have more time, I'll throw in a fourth one. All right, I think there's a lot for us to learn about police brutality and race relations. So here are the three, I would like to say, keys that we can take away to unlock a lot of our frustrations and problems in our society concerning race relations and excessive force and police brutality. One, what we're going to see is that police brutality is not always the result of racism. Okay, and that is the probably key that we all need to have right away. Two, when police brutality is race-based, the legal outcome is dependent on those who are in critical positions of power, or at least usually. And three, political and social activism is an antidote to many of the social and political disparities that we experience, that anyone experience. And so I want to break these three things down, or at least isolate them and give you enough to think about on your own so that you could import them into your lives and be a beacon of change in life in your communities and get other people on board to be proactive in a very efficient way to make change. All right. So let's go to the first point here. I'm going to go straight through these points, hash them out, and elaborate just a little bit, and so that we can get on with our week and make stuff happen. First things first, we have to understand that police brutality is fundamentally, you know, a breach of responsibility. Okay, it's a breach of a certain role. It's a breach of a certain agreement of power. So there are people with sort of a license to use deadly force. People with license to infringe on our freedoms and liberties and stuff. And when they transgress the stipulations as to what deems a situation, a legitimate situation where investigations or restrictions on freedoms are necessary, then we step into police brutality, excessive force, and all these other things. So if we don't understand what the fundamental problem is, then we could attack the wrong issues. Even the issues we are attacking are legitimate issues, if we're attacking the wrong ones, not realizing what the fundamental element is, or the fundamental nature of our problem is, or the complex nature, then we're wasting time, if not making things worse. So, with that said, you know, I propose that we understand that police brutality is fundamentally a breach of responsibility. However, that breach could be caused or provoked by different factors. Superiority complex, negligence, lack of training, and of course, racism. And not to mention, a mix, a blend of these. So a person can just have a superiority complex. We see this in school, in clubs, everywhere in everyday society. So seeing this happening in certain areas of our society, in certain institutions, should not be a surprise, because we are talking about human beings and the natures of human beings. So police brutality could be caused by superiority complex, negligence, lack of training, and racism. And with that said, I think we would be directed towards the fundamental grievances. Now, the grievances in particular for certain parents and family members and communities and politicians, local officials, may be expressed along certain lines, such as racism in some cases or negligence in other cases. The bottom line is police brutality is a breach of a person's role and position. And we have to aim at that scenario. We have to aim at that complex, that logic. And that's a political move. It's not just social, but it's political. It's both. But we want to make sure that people are held accountable fundamentally for the breach of responsibility, or we have to reconsider that particular branch or institution in our society. And when the conversation elevates to that sort of view, then I think our system will be more responsive. In other words, if we begin to act on the pillars of that institution in general, the people who are given authority over the others, over the police officers who have to walk the beat, funding. If we, you know, get to the mayor, if we get to the Justice Department, get to the president, and start pulling on those strings, then you will see immediate change. But we'll talk about that later. Change, of course, other things are necessary. All right. So I think that first we need to shift our vantage point and get beyond the myopic views that we often get stuck in, because the issue is not just about racism. And I'm black and I'm saying this. The issues, I think it's a little bit more complex and it's broader. Because I can't sit here and say that every police officer is racist. I can't sit here and say that every police officer has a superiority complex. And I can't sit here and say every police officer is negligent. I've seen police officers with amazing training and amazing skill. I know some personally who know how to communicate. So if we want to get to a problem, we need to really understand the nature of that problem as best we can. And now this problem obviously has many, many sides. And so we have to, I think, try to get to the bottom, to the essence. And that's what I'm trying to do. So with that said, here's the next deal. If we fail to understand that police brutality is fundamentally a breach of responsibility, and we just start attacking the wrong problems, the wrong issues, or the issues that are not most relevant to the nature of the problem, then things tend to backfire. Things tend to get worse because we, you know, if someone has sort of a headache and you're a doctor thinking that they have, that they need surgery, and, you know, you're chopping off a foot, or you're cutting up a thigh, or digging in someone's intestine, then you're just going to cause more problems. A person is still going to have a headache. And now the other issues, because you just, like, you know, tampered with parts of the body that are okay. So think about it. The next thing. All right. So the first lesson I think we get from Freddie Gray is that we need to take away is that police brutality is not always a result of racism. Second, coming out of that, that will, if we don't take that view, we will overlook that white and black officers are guilty of perpetrating excessive force of some sort of negligence. Yeah, white or black. And as we see in the Freddie Gray situation, black people are held accountable for Freddie Gray's death. And again, I'm never overlooking racism. I'm never overlooking such problems and the bias towards African Americans. I'm not overlooking that. But I'm trying to look closer at the nature of the issues dealing with police brutality and police relations in the broadest capacity, in the broadest way possible, because if we don't, then we'd just be painting, you know, big pictures that ignore the nuances, and that's never productive. So let's go to the Bureau of Justice Statistics. The issue here is that I think that needs to be discussed more and understood as a sort of basic premise is that the police force itself has undergone a certain decadence of responsibility, or a period of decadence in general. And this is for white and black America, all of our Americas. And so the rates are very high in terms of using excessive force, particularly among males. And so this is happening against white people and black people. And if we ignore that, then we're ignoring a fundamental problem. In fact, I mean, at least I think it's well known that America itself, you know, has the largest incarceration population in the world. And that need to speak to us, for those of us who are concerned about particular aspects of incarceration in the justice system, for those who are concerned about the treatment of African Americans. And so what we see is that understanding that America has an incarceration cancer that's spreading, it's not just a black and white issue. The black and white issue is embedded in what American society values or prioritizes, okay? And once we understand what the priorities are, I think that would direct us to those who are able to lay down these priorities and put them to work as institutions and as policies. Or else, again, we'll be going in, digging in the wrong part of our body when perhaps we need Advil. Or perhaps we do need surgery, and then we are treating it as a headache and just taking Tylenol for something that's really, as I'm calling, a cancer in our society. So we need to really diagnose the situation. So the Justice Department understands that this is a huge issue. Unfortunately, it's tough for the justice system, I would say, to really get to the bottom line when various interest groups are mostly concerned with how the general police brutality and excessive force situation affects their population in particular. And so while it is important to be very specific in particular to people's individual problems or groups' individual problems, we also have to spend a lot of time, as much as possible, getting to the causes or the cause of all of these different problems. Because I think these problems are really symptomatic, again, of what America as a political and economic nation had prioritized for much of its history. So that's the key lesson. That's the number one. Police brutality should be understood as a breach of responsibility. And that breach of responsibility could be provoked or caused in a number of ways. So that is almost saying, I'll say it, a person could be racist, but their racist attitude becomes a problem for me when it is informing or influencing a person's behavior, especially a person who is a civil servant. That's the nature of the problem. Again, somebody could have a superiority complex. You can have a superiority complex if you want. But again, that's going to be a problem if you're holding a gun, or if you are a person that, you know, runs the streets and you're supposed to be checking others who have superiority complex, that's an issue. Now, if somebody want to be negligent and carry a gun, that's a problem for me. These are how the problems are introduced into our society. And introduced in the form of, I think, police matters. And so we have to hold the institution accountable for being on top of training and screening for these different kinds of issues that play out, which are fundamentally breach of responsibility. Because if you don't have a certain skill set, then you need to develop that skill set. If you get past the system without developing a certain skill set, then that's a breach of responsibility. That's, you know, that's something fundamentally wrong with that. It's negligent. And I think when we start looking at it in that way, our conversation, our actions will be more focused and targeted. And we will hit the right pressure points in our society to effect change, which I will get to later. So we're going to take a quick break on that one. I really hope I've persuaded you to some degree that police brutality is fundamentally a breach of responsibility. And that breach could be caused or provoked by a number of factors and a combination of them. And therefore, we need to start, if we want to protest, we need to start protesting or voting on issues that are fundamental to the institution. Because we're not going to be able to change individuals. I mean, people are trying to eradicate racism or spot it. And, you know, I might get in trouble for saying this. The more I think we believe, continue to think mistakenly that racism is institutional, the more we're going to overlook the fact that I think it's more of a social and cultural issue. You cannot erase racism out of a person's mind, but you can set up limitations and forms of accountability that discourage people from acting out their own personal views or their own personal flaws. Okay, I think that is what we need to aim for. And making that a real situation, a reality that a person knows, man, I cannot continue to do this. Or if it's a group, we cannot continue to do this, because once we are caught, it's a wrap. And it's not worth it in the long run. So let me, you know, when I'm with my friends, I'll express my views. But when I'm on a job, I just got to do what I got to do so I can get paid and take care of my family. To some degree, you know, that's the kind of scenario we're looking for. We can't make anyone a saint. And we can't make a person the most open-minded individual in the world. But we can impress upon them that they're held accountable for dereliction of their duties. Alrighty. So I got more to say on this, but I'm going to stop here. And we're going to get back in a few minutes, and talk about the second thing we need to take away from this Freddie Gray tragedy, which is symbolic of a lot of the shootings and killings going on between police and African-American men. So we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks again for tuning in. Ladies and gentlemen, we are back. Okay, so are you ready for this second lesson? All right, the second lesson is dealing with police brutality when it is provoked by racism. What to do? And here's what I notice. In the case of Freddie Gray, I cannot help but notice that the people in the seats of critical power are black. The state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, the mayor, even the Baltimore police chief, Anthony Bates. This is interesting, because in this scenario, we get at least we get the appearance of a certain understanding of the circumstances that's going on. And so far, an indictment or charge. And so what seems to be the case here is that when people who feel like they are not represented properly or fairly have individuals in critical seats of power to represent them, then they see different results. All right, so this gives us clues about the relation to justice, which I think is very complex. And I'm going to have to throw in some caveats here, explain myself, because somebody can take this the wrong way. And so basically, let me just say, you know, I think we have clues about how justice works in politics. the main point I want to say is that having more blacks in positions of power can lead to more just outcomes. But I have to say, I think that this is true to the extent that black people in power will be able to negotiate situations justly. Okay, and what do I mean by that? Well, someone can misinterpret me and say, oh, so the way to treat this problem is just like have people from your own group in places of power. And so until black people have black people in seats of power, or Chinese people have Chinese people in seats of power, that's the only way things can get better. I'm not quite saying that, but there is an element of truth in that. This is very important when a particular group is typically discriminated or stereotyped or neglected. In that case, it's very true. And there's no hiding around this, especially in American history. There's no hiding around the fact that black people have been subjected unfairly to the hells of human nature, sanctioned by law, because black people didn't have individuals to understand their situation and fight on their behalf and make decisions in critical seats of power. So yes, and to that extent, it's true. Now, on the other hand, it's very important to understand that I'm not just saying we need more black people who will just look out for other black people, whether they are right or wrong. It's not the case. I mean, I think more fundamentally, what I am saying is that in general, right, black people should be in seats of power, especially if they occupy, a good number of the population. And more importantly, I guess what I'm getting at is those people who are concerned about the plight of minorities, not just black, or the issues of injustice, need to be in these seats of power. So that means, this is again another road back to the politics. White or black, we have to vote in people or encourage people who have justice in their interest, in their line of sight, into critical seats of power. If we do not follow this logic, then again, we're beating a dead horse. We are just beating the same old tropes of what's wrong without doing anything of substance to make substantial change. All right. Now, again, such a problem is not particular to black people. All right. This is what happens, in any community. I'm an African American talking about this, the context of the black person in America. All right. So this is not racist talking or reverse racism at all. Although I do believe that reverse racism exists in some forms. But this is about realizing justice, realizing the political ideals that America had professed to embrace. So we got to get that together. We have to get it together. We have to, in other words, understand that until we are intensely politically active and getting people in critical seats of power and staying on it and not waiting until after, we're not going to see the change that we deserve, that this country is supposed to have. I think Ferguson should be taken as an example. Ferguson, Missouri, where Michael Brown was killed. About 71% the city is black. And at that time, they had no influence in their city council. And I am happy to say that since then, they were enlightened, motivated to say, listen, we got to take action now. And very recently, they turned things around. African Americans now occupy at least half of the city council. And I hate to pit this in a Zoroastrian way, like good against bad. But the whole idea is that if you want representation, then you have to vote for that. And you have to work for that. And if you want somebody to at least be in a critical seat of power on your behalf, they don't have, the person doesn't have to be black, all right? But if you want a person who got your back in a political sense in terms of justice, okay, strictly speaking, justice, then you need to put that person in power. And they were able to do it. It wasn't even a problem. They just had to encourage everybody to vote together. So critical seats of power, we need to know what they are. Like the state's attorney office, the White House, right? The mayor, police commissioner, police chief, judges, courts, medical examiners, all these kinds of things are important. Yes, they are, folks. They are important. Alrighty. So that's number two. So number two is when police brutality is race-based, the legal outcome is dependent. It's largely dependent on whoever is in the critical seat of power to make key decisions. All right. And I actually just sort of segue into number three, in a sense, to say that we need to start occupying those seats in terms of our interests. We need to get people, again, can be African-American. It doesn't have to be African-American, but it has to be someone who's intrinsically concerned with the issue of justice or the lack thereof. So that means the ball is in our court. And we should not have to wait for another Freddie Gray or Trayvon Martin or Mike Brown or Eric Garner to start thinking about this. You have to examine your particular community right now and see and measure the political activism and participation. Alrighty. We're going to take another final break, and we're going to go into number three and see what's going on. All right, we'll be right back. Alrighty, so we're at number three, and I'm getting excited talking about these things here. So number three is political and social activism is an antidote. And obviously I've talked a little bit about that in this session before. So let's just get into this. I do feel that American citizens are becoming more and more politically active and vigilant in this generation. Actually, there was on CNN, there was a black guy in Baltimore who was initially hesitant to come forward to discuss the details regarding Freddie Gray's arrest. For some reason, he decided to be engaged and vocal in his community and started using an app to start recording bad behavior. And he's now determined to hold civil servants, police officers in his community responsible. And he's a great example of the kind of mindset that we all have to take on. And this is really, you know, the key lesson that the protesters who stood up and marched the streets, not just in during Freddie, you know, not just in the aftermath of the Freddie Gray tragedy, but also Mike Brown and everyone else, all of our fallen citizens, are, you know, they are showing us that one, to make a statement, we have to stand up and be loud about it. And two, we have to find ways that intervene with the process of police brutality, such as recording with, you know, our cell phones and tablets. You know what's really funny is that it's almost like Big Brother in reverse. We were all, for one, at one point in time, afraid of the street cameras and stuff. But now, technology is flipped on the system. I don't really think it ever flipped, but I'm just saying it in this way because people are really anti-government, anti the system. But even if we were to think of it in those terms, we realize that technology has been a useful tool for citizens who feel subjected by the government, who feel that their freedoms are being transgressed. And so, anyway, to go back to this main point, we have to model ourselves after those actions that seem to produce change, that to get attention. I'm sure you remember the young man who intervened when Fox News tried to step in the matter and paint you know, their infamous pictures of African Americans in such crises, and he wasn't permitted. He wasn't allowed to get in there and cast a demonizing view of the matter. And so that shows that we have options. We have a lot of options. We have roles to fill. They're not just options. These are roles that we have to at some point in time start taking on. We have to, you know, step into the role and start dictating the narrative that's most appropriate to the particular circumstances that we go through. Otherwise, we're going to keep saying the same old thing I always hear. And I'm just really getting tired of it. You know, it's the media casting things on us. And this is what the man is doing. Yes. If you're just learning what the man is doing, what media is doing now, you got to be at least 6 years old or something. At most, I would say. All right, if you're an adult older than I am, or you've been around the block a few times, and we kind of know the biases that goes on. And even then, I don't think I'm using this language, I don't really talk in terms of the system. I see people as human beings with their own individual interests and collective group interests. And people who like similar things get together and have fun and continue to do the things they do. And these people may be in government or may be in other institutions of our society. That's just how I see the matter. But again, to run along with this narrative that is the system and this is all that's wrong. Okay, let's start doing something about it. So the deal is solutions. We have to continue to talk about solutions. We have to start exercising what we think are solutions consistently, collectively. And some of the solutions, I think, come from being political active. and engage in breeding a culture of politicized individuals. Individuals who are engaging in the political arena. Voting is number one. Protesting is number two. You can flip them if you want, depending on your cup of tea. But between one and two, protesting and voting. And number three, our economic choices. And that could be number one for somebody else too. So I'm just giving you a list of them. So I'm just keeping track of how many I'm telling you. But again, I always have these little devil's advocates in my ear because that's how I think in a sense. But the point is, we got to be politically active, engage. Got to be socially active and engage, because that's what the media actually projects, right? How our social response, and how we react to the situation when the cameras are out. And three, what we do with money, who we invest in, how we invest in our community, how we invest in our children. And I would throw one more, and this is a cultural one. I think that we have to develop a dialogue among each other and with the nation. So listen, at some point, you know, we're going to have to talk to our community, to the individuals, the kids of our community, even the cops, and say, listen, enough is enough. I think we're going to have to do that formally and informally. We're going to have to encourage the kind of behavior we want among the officers. We can kill them with kindness. We can kill them with leadership on the matter, standing up to the matter and letting them know there's some who are great. There are some great officers who just don't really speak up. You have some who speak up, but no one carries their echoes. There are no walls to bounce off of. And so we have to be the walls and talk about these issues to each other. Spread the good news, as the Bible would say, the gospel. So I think you get where I'm coming from. You know, this is a matter that's really been on my mind, and I've been in a lot of conversations about this. Been a lot of discussions and debates, arguments. And again, you know, I'm, at least for me personally speaking, I want to hear people talk more constructively about the matter. Yes, I don't mind the conversations, you know, being, you know, seminars on what's wrong with our society. I get that. And that's important. I partake in that as well. But we can't dedicate all of our time to just reacting and talking about what's wrong. It's a tough road. Life is tough, everybody. But life is tough, I think, for people who are in a tough spot, right? And so if you're in a tough spot, you want to make a change. So this is what we have to do. Some people, life is not tough in that way. They have different issues. They're thinking about whether or not they want to go to this island or that island for vacation. And that's all good. Okay, so for those of you who are really concerned with this matter, we have to get together and start being proactive in our dialogue, in our rhetoric, and in our actions politically, economically, socially, and culturally. All right, so that's it for today. I think I'm running out of time. Again, this is a pre-recorded. I should have mentioned that at the beginning. Hopefully you saw that in the title. So if you have any questions, pushback, suggestions, email me at info@theworldofideas.com. Thanks again for tuning in to The World of Ideas. Look forward to hearing from you, and I'll be back next week. We're here every Sunday, 8:30 to 9:30. Take care, everybody. Have a great week, and make it happen. Change the world one conversation at a time.